So, having found Ecclesiastes 3, look at verse 18. Let's start off by reading verse 18. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. And by beasts there, he means animals. So he says here that men are like animals. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. So let me kind of explain what the sentiment of Solomon is here. He says, I looked out at people, and I saw that people were just like animals in this sense. They both just died. That one dies and goes to the ground, and the other one dies and goes to the ground. And all of this seemed really, and here he uses the word vanity, but pointless or empty, meaningless. That's the sense of what he's saying. Continuing on, verse 20. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to the dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of beast goes down to the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? So what he's saying is, he's saying, look, we all go to the same place. We all die and our bodies are committed to the ground, just like a dog's, just like a cat, just like any animal out there. It's all the same. So what's the point? That's what he's saying. And then he says, who knows whether the spirit of a man actually goes upward and anything else happens to him, and whether the spirit of an animal just goes into the earth and ceases. That's kind of a weird passage. It's a weird passage, and I do have to say that in general, if you are a Christian, you should feel fairly uncomfortable with what was just said. Because as Christians, we tend to kind of look at ourselves and say, no, there is something fundamentally different from us and from animals. And what's more, we tend to think that the end of our story, the finality, is not in the ground. I don't just end with my body being committed to the dirt. What's more, I don't think as a Christian we're supposed to look at our lives and say it's pointless and meaningless and this doesn't make any sense. Which means, if that's what you believe, then you disagree with this passage. And that should make you equally uncomfortable. Because it's the Bible. And as a Christian, you're supposed to always agree with the Bible. You guys understand? So we're in a bit of a quandary here. I wanted to start off with this passage for a couple of reasons. One, and for those of you guys who are at youth camp, I did this in youth camp as well, but I'm only this part is ripped off from youth camp. One, I want to use this passage to kind of talk about how we should read the Bible. You see, the tendency amongst Christians is to kind of look at the Bible as almost a self-help manual. It's something that if I look in the index and I find the proper topic, I can go and find that passage in the Bible and it'll tell me how I'm supposed to live my life. And that basically, if I read it every single day, eventually I'm going to stumble upon different things that are directions on how I should live a better life or how I should be to, you know, as a Christian or any of those kinds of things. We think of every passage of the Bible almost as if it's one of the Ten Commandments, just something you're supposed to do and something you're supposed to think. And this is not the case. It is not the case at all. You see, the Bible is compiled of all sorts of different kinds of writing. And you have to understand that every passage of Scripture is something that if you were to just look at it alone, you could kind of get yourself in a little bit of trouble. You see, you've got to ask yourself when you read the Bible, what is it that the writer is trying to communicate? That's the first thing you need to ask yourself. And secondly, you need to ask yourself, and why did God put this in the Bible? Why has God used this? What is his point in kind of giving this to me? You see, we can run into all sorts of different problems. I'll give you an example. If you look through the Bible, as I said a moment ago, you find all sorts of different kinds of writing. On the one hand, you'll find things like what we would expect to find. You'll find rules and commandments, like the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments is, in fact, the kind of thing that you would expect to find. You open it up, it tells you what to do, you're supposed to do it. If you don't do it, you're messing up. There are things like that. But there are all sorts of other things. For instance, the Song of Solomon is a love song written from a man. Actually, it's not even written entirely by one man. It's an intertwining love song between a man and a woman and their various other characters. And they're all kind of contributing to this love song. And it's not the kind of thing that you look at and say, okay, how am I supposed to live my life by reading it? Much of what we find in the scripture is actually history. It's actually a tale of what happened. And you would be in a lot of trouble if you looked at the history and said, okay, I need to live my life the way this book is telling me, or the way this story is telling me I should live. So, case in point. Abraham. You guys are probably somewhat familiar with Abraham, the time when him and his wife, they moved down to Egypt because famine had hit the land. And he goes down there, and he, on the way, he tells his wife, Sarah, she was called Sarai at the time, he says, hey, listen, you're really, really beautiful, and I'm nervous. I'm nervous because I think when we get to Egypt, all the Egyptians are going to look at you, and they're going to want you, and so they're going to kill me and take you. And that wouldn't be good for either one of us. So why don't we tell them that you're my sister? So they go down into Egypt. And sure enough, he goes to everybody and he says, this is my sister, Sarai. And so when Pharaoh sees her, he's like, wow, she really is good looking. I will take your sister. Thank you very much. And he puts her in his harem, and his intention is to make her one of his concubines. You see, just I want to pause here for a minute and say, if you read that story, which is history, and it did happen, but if you read it and say, oh, that's how I'm supposed to live my life, then you will be fundamentally making a huge mistake. You see, the Bible is not always just telling you how you're supposed to live your life. You really need to learn how to read it by asking yourself, what is it here for? And the book of Ecclesiastes, I think, is a very unique little book. And I think it's here for a very unique little purpose. And to kind of understand, let's turn backwards. We're going to back up. We're going to stay in the book of Ecclesiastes today, but I'm going to look at a few passages in Ecclesiastes. Back up to chapter 2, look at verse 1. Here we kind of are going to see a little bit of what's going on in this book. This is written by Solomon, who is the king of Israel at the time, the son of David. And I want you to look at what he says here in verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. So what Solomon's saying here is he's saying, you know what? I was sitting here and I thought, you know what? I'm going to try out pleasure. I'm going to just make myself feel good. And I did it. And he goes, and I saw that that was empty and pointless. I said of laughter, it is mad. Of pleasure, what use is it? Verse 3, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. And here we see a little glimpse of what Solomon's writing about. Solomon is saying that he committed himself to trying to understand the point of life. Why am I here? What's my purpose? What did God put man on the earth for? And he starts off here saying, I tried a bunch of different things. I tried wine, and I tried pleasure. I tried partying. That's kind of what he says here he committed himself to. And what I found is that it was pointless and empty. In other words, I did it, and it gave me no sense of fulfillment. It gave me no sense of peace. It gave me no sense of purpose. Continue on. So in verse 4, he says, I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks. I planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forests of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, men, women, concubines, and the delights of the sons of men. So he says, in addition to pleasure and partying and all of these kinds of things, I tried other things. I tried to make great works. I built great buildings, and I built vineyards and planted farms. And he goes, I accrued wealth, and I accrued servants, and I accrued everything that a human being could imagine accruing. And what you're going to find is, verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found no pleasure in all my toil and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered that all my hand had done, and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, and here's the key, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. He says, I tried it all, I had it all, and in the end, what did I find it all to be? It was empty and pointless, and it was like trying to chase after the wind and catch it. Now, why did I want to look at this book, and why did I want to give you a little bit of the context? Well, here's why. This is, as I said a moment ago, written by Solomon. He's the king of Israel at this time. And what I want you to really understand about Solomon and his reign is that at this point, this is the golden age of Israel's history. This is the point at which Israel is perfectly at rest on all sides from all of her enemies. There is no war, and it is the only time in her long storied history when there is no war. She is absurdly wealthy. Everybody in the land has money, not just Solomon, but Solomon is the wealthiest of all. And indeed, as the scripture tells us, at this point, he's the wealthiest man in the world. The neighboring countries are slaves to the Israelites. Solomon rules at this point an empire that stretches all the way from what is today Iraq, all the way down to what is today Egypt. And what is he finding in his life? He's finding that he's restless. He's restless. And he's wandering. He's sitting here and he's thinking, I need to figure out, why am I here? What's the point of it all? And when I think about him and I think about his situation, I can't help but think about us. I can't help but think about us because I really think that maybe more than any other people in the history of the world, we are in his position. We're in a situation where we are at rest. We are at peace, and we are enormously wealthy. Now, please don't get me wrong. I know there are conflicts in the world, and I know that we have recently fought two wars, and we've sent troops to die, and I know that we have situations, we have that reality facing us. But you have to understand, it's a little different for us than it has been for most people throughout the history of the world, because we genuinely are at rest in our homes. Nobody's going to be able to attack us for the most part, and we live in the comfort of that reality. We wake up every morning not thinking that anything bad is going to happen like that. The only dangers that we really face are from our own people for the most part. And we are enormously wealthy. And I know you might kind of look at yourself and you might say, well, I'm not that wealthy. I mean, I'm, you know, fairly, you know, middle class. Or maybe even some of you would look at yourself and say, actually, I'm quite poor. I don't have much of an income, and I'm really struggling to make ends meet. But what I want you to understand is this. And I really believe this, is that we are living, you know, probably over the last 30 years in the wealthiest civilization in the history of the world. We don't have the kind of poverty that most of the world has dealt with throughout human history. Let me just kind of illustrate this. When I was in just out of college, I was in my second or third year out of college. I was curious where my income stacked up against the income of the rest of the world. And so I went on Google, and Google had this kind of I don't know what to call it. It was some kind of an income assessment tool where you could enter your income and it would actually rank you in the world. And at the time I was making about $30,000 a year, which is not awesome, but it's not terrible either. It was a decent wage, a lower middle class wage. And so I went online, I entered that income, and it told me that I was in the 98th percentile of the world. What that means is that 98% of the people in the world were poorer than I was. You understand? 98% of the people. So then I thought about it, and I remembered that when I was a kid, my mom had told me this, so it always kind of stuck in my head. Two things. One, she always told me that we were living below the poverty line, so I knew that we were below what the United States regarded as poor, impoverished. And I remembered how much money she made. She was a single mom raising two kids, and she made $14,000 a year. And so I sat there and I thought to myself, okay, I remember that. Now, that was in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And so I thought to myself, okay, and this was around 2002 when I did this on the computer, I'm curious what 14,000 ranks. So I entered 14,000 a year into that same calculator. And it told me that we were in the 96th percentile in 2002. What that means is, 96% of the people in the world are poorer than my mom was when she was raising us. And we were poor in our country. And we were. I mean, in a real sense. I don't want to make it sound like there isn't difficulty and hardship financially, because I know that that's true. So I'm not trying to say that. But what I want you to understand is, I want you to understand there is like real, deep, horrible poverty in the world, right? The kind where people literally sit there and go to bed going, I don't know if I will have food tomorrow. Where people literally have no hope of a kind of shelter that they'll be able to erect over themselves. And the reality is that this civilization that we live in, America and really Western Europe, it's just not really possible, for the most part, to be in that kind of a circumstance, that kind of a situation. We are enormously wealthy. I'll use one more point to illustrate. I had a friend who was a sociology major, and he was telling me about a professor of his, not a professor of his, but of a professor that he knew of who had written an article. She was a sociology prof in Texas, and she decided that she would spend a year homeless, panhandling, just with one basic goal, and that was to see how much money she could accrue from panhandling. And she, of course, spent many nights on the streets, but she would go home occasionally, wash up, spend time with her family, write her blog, you know, email her profs, that kind of a thing. At the end of the year, she had made $300,000. Now, again, please don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that every person who is homeless is going makes that kind of money in the year when they're panhandling, any of those kinds of things. Not only that, the economy is weaker now than it was back then, so as we take hits, the homeless take hits. I'm not trying to say any of those kinds of things. The thing I want to point out is poverty in America is not the same kind of thing as poverty in the rest of the world. You guys understand? And so we live in an enormously comfortable time. And what does that mean for us? Well, I think for us that means something similar to what it meant for Solomon. I think what it means is that we find ourselves restless because we have lots of time and because we have lots of money. And because whereas many people throughout the history of the world, every single day, they're just fighting to live. We don't worry about that. We just got time to waste and money to spend. And so we sit there and we wander in our hearts and our minds. We're restless. And what does that mean for us? Well, it looks very different for different people. For some of us, it's our place of employment. It's our job. I'm working. I have a decent wage. There's really nothing wrong with it, but I'm restless. I don't like it. I've been doing it for too long. I don't want to be here anymore. And so I start to wander and I start to think, is there another place for me? And I start to put the meaning of my life, like my purpose into that, into the hope of finding some new place of employment, some new work that will give me a sense of purpose and meaning. For some of us, it's sadly our marriages. I think it's one of the great causes of divorce in our culture today is you have a marriage and for all intents and purposes, the marriage is great, but a person just starts to feel that wandering heart. And he starts saying to himself, man, I've been married for 10 years to the same person. And the way I feel today, it's not the same way that I felt at the start of it all. And his heart wanders and he starts to wonder, is there maybe something better on the other side? Is there maybe something, somebody else who I was meant for, maybe my soulmate's out there and maybe it's not my wife. And so I wander, right? We have these wandering hearts in every aspect of our life, whether it's our jobs, whether it's our marriages, with our friendships. Sometimes it's our churches. We go to church and we're like, you know, I've heard the same kinds of sermons too much. I've heard all of his stories. I've heard all of his illustrations and so maybe there's something else out there for me. We're always looking to go to a better place, something that will give us a better sense of fulfillment. And I really think it's rooted in the same thing that it was rooted in for Solomon. And that's what's going on with Solomon here. Now, that's kind of bleak and sad in general. But there's hope. You see, a lot of people actually, I think, try to resolve this sense of restlessness and this wandering heart that they have by actually trying to get out of the situation. We actually feel like, well, maybe if I just leave America or leave the first world and go live someplace where I actually am forced to sustain myself and to live, you know, maybe I'll find meaning and sense there. And I've had a lot of friends who've done that. It's kind of worked in a sense. But I don't think it's hopeless for us. You see, I think that we have our place in the world too. I think we have our purpose in the world as well. And I think here Solomon is going to hit on something that's very important. I want you to skip ahead now to chapter 3 here in Ecclesiastes. And look here at verse 11. Chapter 3, verse 11. Solomon here is talking about God. And what does he say? He says concerning God that he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in man's heart. Yet, so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. The book of Ecclesiastes is it's a weird book sometimes, because as you read through it, Solomon is sometimes sitting here saying, meaninglessness, everything is meaningless. I don't know anything. I don't know if there's life after death. I don't even know if there's purpose. I don't know if God cares. He's going through having these kinds of these moments. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of the book, he'll sit there and say, wait a minute. No, God has actually done these amazing things. And it's so confusing when you read it that many scholars have tried to argue that the book of Ecclesiastes was written by multiple different people. And that really, whoever wrote it to begin with was this depressed, sad, horribly confused person who hates life and is writing the book. And then along came these Jewish rabbis who said, well, we can't have such a depressing book in the Bible. So they would add encouraging verses about God. And they argue for this by saying, well, nobody would be so two-sided. And I go, really? Nobody? Because that's definitely what goes on in my life. I mean, are you telling me you haven't, Professor, had moments where you sit there and question reality and question if everything you believe is true and question whether or not there's purpose and what that purpose is, and at the same time have those moments of great clarity when you feel like you absolutely know what it is and when you feel very connected with God? Because that is the story of my life, right? I mean, I can't imagine a human being not going through those two things. And if there's one reason that I do believe the book of Ecclesiastes is here for, if you want to know why did God put this in here, I believe that God gave us the book of Ecclesiastes to tell us all that we are not alone. That everybody's the same, that we all have the same kinds of pains and confusions and questions and heartaches and wonderings, and that it doesn't mean that we are alienated from God or alienated from His grace. And there continues to be the hope of resolution, as Solomon will have. So here in verse 11, he, in the midst of this going kind of depressive, all of a sudden being up, he says, wait, God has made everything beautiful in His time. And then he says something very important. He has put eternity in their hearts. And I wanted to look at this verse for one main reason. Because this longing that I've, or this desire, I should say, this wandering heart that we've been talking about, this sense of restlessness that I think we as humans really feel, especially in our culture, I think it actually has a purpose, a potentially great purpose. It has a very negative possible use. We could really use it poorly. We can use it poorly by doing the things that so many of us do in our sin. But it has a positive use, and it is this. You see, I believe that one of the main sources of this restlessness and this sense of wandering is a longing that God has put in our hearts. You see, I think He created us with something deep inside, a desire for Him. And I think that's what Solomon's saying here when he says that God has put eternity in their hearts. He has put something deep inside of us, and it is something which cries out for and longs for a connection with God Himself. It's something that yearns for a relationship with Him. And here's the big thing. Nothing else can fill that. Nothing else can fill that. And so everybody who is not in fellowship with God, who is not in communion with God, their hearts are going to wander like crazy, looking for something that will bring them into connection that in such a way that will fill that void in their life. And you might say, well, but Tom, I'm a Christian and I have that longing too. Why is that here? If I'm a Christian and I know God, then why do I still sometimes feel that longing? Why do I sometimes have a wandering heart? Why do I sometimes feel restless where I am? And I would say this, Because the reality is that although you as a Christian may have a relationship with God, you may know God, and I know God, it's not as if my heart is just in constant, amazing communion with Him at all times, right? The fact is I go through dry spells. The fact is there are moments when I am shut off to Him. The fact is there are times when I'm not speaking to Him and I don't sense Him speaking to me. And the fact is that there are plenty of times in my life when I am turning also to all of the little things that I think will give me a sense of fulfillment and a sense of satisfaction, but they don't. Because I'm a human being. And so I turn there. And Solomon turned there. And so Solomon here is trying to, I think, in a moment of clarity, he's answering his question. He's reminding us that in the midst of this struggle that we go through, where we find ourselves restless and wandering, and where we find ourselves questioning and doubting, that we remember that at its core, at its root, there is something there that God has put in us. And it's a glorious thing. And I want to add something to it. C.S. Lewis says that when you're thirsty, you need water. When you're hungry, you need food. And the fact that your body has built into it this mechanism which brings about thirst, and the fact that your body has in it this mechanism which brings about hunger, tells you that there is something there that can satisfy your need. Lewis says, the fact that you have this longing for something eternal, the fact that you have this longing for God, that is an indication that God is actually there. That there is something there that can actually fulfill that need. And I actually do believe that the primary source, the primary cause of most of our sins, of most of our failings, of most of our fallings into wandering away from God is rooted in the fact that we are not filling that void and that we're not connecting with God in that place where we need to. And instead, we're filling it with all sorts of other kinds of things, whatever they might be. And they're not necessarily, they don't, by the way, need to even be bad things, right? Most of us have hobbies. Most of us have things that we just enjoy doing. And it's very easy to make those things kind of the main point of our lives. I've been listening to this theology podcast lately where a bunch of guys get on the podcast and discuss theological topics, talk about God. And I was listening to it actually on the way out here, and I realized something as I'm listening to it. I realized, oh, these guys, and I don't want to be offensive here, but it's these guys are nerds. And what I meant, see, I'm using the word nerd in a very different way from what you might expect. When I say these guys are nerds, I don't mean that they dress a certain way or have a certain kind of style. What I mean is, this is, I think, kind of culturally what the term nerd has come to mean, is they obsess about certain kinds of things, right? I would stylize myself a nerd because I really get into like movies and books and comic books and music, and I will geek out on them. I will literally get to a point where it's, like, if I meet somebody who has the same interest, I'm like, let's talk about the movie. And it's all I talk about. Are you with me on that? And I can literally get in this mode where I'm like, man, I would love to just sit down and watch this set of movies all day. Or man, what are the new albums out? And I'll get online and I'll literally just start looking up best albums of 2014. And if I see a bunch of albums on 2014 that I haven't heard, I'll start playing it on my Spotify. Because I'm like, oh, I got to hear it. I don't like that one. Or, you know, things of that particular nature. I have websites that I will list and rank my own things, and I'll write commentaries on movies and TV shows. I'm not joking. I do all of that kind of stuff. And here's the thing, that every now and again I stop and I realize, whoa, this is a total waste of my life. And the thing is that we all have this, there's something about us as humans where we find things that we love. And we give ourselves wholeheartedly to them. And as I'm listening to these theologians, I'm like, whoa, these guys, none of them are professional theologians. These guys are geeks about theology. They just love talking about the Bible and stuff. And I'm like, man, that's where I want to be. I want to be at the point where it's like, I'm geeking out on the scriptures. And where what's going on in my life is that when I have a free moment, I don't want to just sit down and watch a movie or talk with a friend about the newest fads and whatever. I want to sit down and I want to talk theology and I want to talk about God and I want to talk about scriptures and I want to talk about the power of gospel in my life. And if I have free time, I want to be down on my knees in prayer, seeking the Lord, reading the scriptures, reading the godly men and women who have gone before me and what they have to say about God, and allowing myself to really let God be the God of my life and not the so many multitudinous other things. And I think that if that happens, if we allow that in our lives, then this restlessness, this wandering, it will be put down. And this longing that is in us, this longing will be realized. One last word about longing. One of the things about longing is I think it's something God keeps in us to keep a fire alive for Him. You know what I mean? I can't even describe what I mean by this longing. I remember one time when I was in high school, I got off work. Well, it was actually just out of high school. I got off work and my best friend and I, we threw our fishing poles in the back of his truck and we jumped in and we decided to drive to the Oregon coast, which was only about an hour and a half or so from where we lived. And we were just going to go fishing and along the way, stop at rivers, whatever. And I remember on the way, I said, "Where are we going to sleep tonight?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, are we going to get a hotel?" And he goes, "No, we're not going to get a hotel." And I go, "Well, why wouldn't we get a hotel?" And he says, "You don't pay money to sleep. There's tons of ground everywhere." And I said, I like beds. I don't mind paying money. I'll pay for you. And he goes, "I will never let another person pay money for me to sleep when there's plenty of places for me to sleep." So I said, "So where are we going to sleep?" And he goes, "The beach, probably." And I go, "Isn't that illegal?" And he goes, "Illegal? Nobody's going to tell me I can't sleep on the ground." So whatever it was, we end up going to the beach and we throw out our blankets on the beach and we lay down, which is kind of risky because it's not like the Oregon coast has a stationary climate. You know what I mean? We could have been in some trouble, but it ended up being perfect. It was the perfect night. And I remember we just kicked back, laid out on the blanket, looked up at the stars, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. You could see every star. And I just remember looking out at it. And I mean, I was 18 years old. And it was just one of the great moments of my life. And it was one of the great moments of my life because there was something stirring inside of me. I saw the bigness of everything, and it gave me a longing for something that was out there. And I've looked back distinctly on that moment as a time where I just remember connecting with the reality of God. And so you see, like everything, as Christians, we don't sit there and look at ourselves and say that, well, I should put it this way. The sin in our lives is always a corruption of something that was meant to be good and beautiful, right? The sin that we practice, it's always because we or because the evil one took something that was meant to be beautiful and corrupted it and twisted it. And the longing that was put in us is meant to be beautiful. It's meant to be something that stirs our hearts and draws us in connection with Him. And it becomes sinful and horrible as we draw away from God and we allow it to degrade. I want you to turn to Ecclesiastes 12. This is the last passage we're going to look at, and we'll finish here. Ecclesiastes 12:13. If there's one passage in this book that scholars like to say some rabbi added later, it's this one. And I think that's a horrible misunderstanding. Because after Solomon goes back and forth throughout this whole book with his doubts, his questions, his feelings of emptiness, as well as his statements of great faith, going back and forth, he ends with this in verse 13. "The end of the matter is this: all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." You see, at the end of it all, as he's wrestled through his longing, you see, if you read this book in the hopes that Solomon's going to answer all of your questions or that he answers all of his questions, you'll be disappointed. He doesn't. He goes through it always wrestling. But at the end of it, he has such an amazing thing to say. He says, "I've gone through it all, and what I can say is this one thing: fear God and keep His commandments. because that is man's all. That is his whole purpose. And I want you to understand that in walking with the Lord and in being a Christian, there are these times, like what I just described, where you feel so immensely connected with God and where you feel his reality and his presence in such a profound way. And there are those times when that restlessness of your heart is put at ease. There are those times when everything makes sense and everything is right. But there are times when it's not. And there are the other times, which is most of the time, when it's just blah. Meaning, you don't feel especially restless, and you don't feel especially connected. You're just living life. And it is the thing you need to understand that Solomon has hit on so amazingly here is that the Christian life is not caught up in the highs and the lows. And it's not caught up in the wanderings and the longings and in the feelings. The Christian life is really about plugging along and persevering daily in the things you need to be doing. Do you feel connected with God? It's unfortunate if you don't. But that doesn't change the fact that you need to be obedient to him and to his word. It doesn't change the fact that your responsibilities are the same. Do you feel like praying? It doesn't change the fact that you need to be praying. Do you feel like reading the word? If you don't, it doesn't change the fact that you need to be reading the word. Do you feel like being obedient? It doesn't change the fact that you need to be obedient. It's kind of like being in a marriage. In a marriage, there are highs and there are lows. There are moments of wandering in the heart of an individual in a marriage, and there are moments of great longing for your spouse. But most of it is just life. And the bottom line is regardless of whether you're in a moment of great longing, in a moment of great wandering, or in kind of the even keelness, you still have to do your responsibility of loving your spouse, and of loving your children, and of carrying on life, because that's where the meat of life is. That's what it is. And if there's one thing I think we can learn from Ecclesiastes, I think it's that. And so I encourage you, read Ecclesiastes, study it. Don't be discouraged by the question Solomon asks. Remember, God's teaching us that we're not alone. And always remember how Solomon finishes that book. And remember that for yourself. Obey God, keep his commandments, submit to him, love him, for that is man's all.